A 2010 Gallup poll asking Americans to assess the last nine presidents gave John F. Kennedy the highest ranking and highest approval rating, 85%. Historian Robert Dallek, who the New York Times called Kennedy's leading biographer, and whose JFK biography, An Unfinished Life, was a number one New York Times bestseller, was somewhat bemused by this appraisal. For while he admired Kennedy's tenure, Dallek's own in-depth study of the man and his presidency had offered a more nuanced assessment of its achievements and flaws. The poll rekindled Dallek's interest in Kennedy's leadership, and he decided to revisit the subject in his new book, Camelot's Court, Inside the Kennedy White House. It is a pleasure to welcome Robert Dallek to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate it.
Nice to be with you.
When you saw the poll, and obviously you have long understood JFK's approval and the love from the American people, what got you thinking specifically about his time, his tenure, and ultimately the legacy?
Well, what was clear to me is that he was a significant president, despite the fact that he was only there for 1,000 days. It was the sixth briefest presidency in the country's history. But I couldn't think of him as a great president in a league with Washington, Lincoln, FDR, maybe TR, and Woodrow Wilson. But that's the way the American public saw him. And so it seemed to me that it might be interesting to take a second look at him. And what was I missing that the public seemed to be seeing? And also what occurred to me was the fact that Doris Kearns Goodwin had written this very successful, appealing book about Lincoln, The Team of Rivals, and there had been so many books about Lincoln, and yet she found a kind of new way to have a window onto his presidency by looking at his interactions with the cabinet officers, the men around him. And so I thought it'd be interesting to look at the Ministry of Talent, as Ted Sorensen called it, or as the journalist David Halberstam later described it, the best and the brightest who populated the Kennedy administration.
You write in the book that perhaps the best way to understand and assess Kennedy's presidential performance is through his interactions with the men whom, as you say, Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter and political advisor, called his Ministry of Talent. This was a group of academics and businessmen, lawyers, foreign policy and national security experts. How did they come together?
Well, Kennedy was the one who brought them together. Of course, some of them had been involved in his campaign or his political career going back to his House and Senate days. But the ones who were most immediately appointed to the presidency, like Robert McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, and McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, Kennedy appointed them not only because they were so extraordinarily accomplished and intelligent, but also because he needed to create a kind of bipartisan administration. He had won the election in 1960 by only 118,000 votes, and he needed to reach out to some moderate Republicans, and that's what McNamara and Bundy gave him. Also, he didn't know the people he brought into his cabinet, like Dean Rusk or C. Douglas Dillon, who was the Secretary of the Treasury and had been in the Eisenhower administration. And then, of course, he appointed Robert Kennedy, his brother, as Attorney General, and he got some flack for doing that. Robert Kennedy hardly had exceptional credentials to fill that post, but Kennedy said in private, "I needed someone who I could put my feet up with and talk to candidly." And that's the role that Bobby Kennedy played. Kennedy had no chief of staff, but essentially Robert Kennedy played that role. He was, as I describe it in one chapter, he was the advisor in chief.
You talk in the book, and I find it fascinating, about how each of these men really, they were competing for the president's attention and competing to to have their particular ideas forwarded.
Yes, that's typical of what happens in a presidential administration. You get a lot of ambitious and successful people who are accustomed to being a force, an influence. Their voice is heard. And so when they get into this situation where they're one of a number of forceful, successful people who are reaching for influence, they become very competitive. And this was particularly the case over things like the foreign policy decisions that were being made, because Kennedy was essentially a foreign policy president. He used to say that politics can unseat you, but foreign policy can kill you. And so he was largely focused on foreign affairs, Cuba, relations with the Soviet Union, a nuclear test ban treaty, the problems with the Soviets over Berlin, and ultimately Vietnam. And so there was a lot of competition among his advisors as to how he should go about dealing with each of these issues. And that particularly came to the fore during the Cuban Missile Crisis. And also, there was quite a battle, internal battle over Vietnam.
You portray the president in the book as having certainly being an astute judge of character. And I'm interested in how you believe that both helped and hurt him in his relationships with these men.
Well, initially he saw them as very, as I say, accomplished and intelligent men, and he was inclined to listen to them. But in the Bay of Pigs fiasco, where he listened to the experts at the CIA and the military chiefs and even some of his, new advisors, and he went forward with this invasion, this operation that he gave sanction to, and it proved to be a disaster. And afterwards he walked around saying, "How could I have been so stupid?" And it sobered him up, so to speak. And he went to France after that and saw Charles de Gaulle, who said to him that he should surround himself with the smartest, most accomplished people, and hear what they have to say. But at the end of the day, he had to make his own judgments. And he remembered what Harry Truman said, "The buck stops here." And so his presidency was a learning experience. And you see the way in which he dealt with the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was really quite a departure from what had happened during the Bay of Pigs operation.
When it came to the decisions, especially in the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it came to the decision, it ultimately, as you say, the buck stops here. So do you believe the decision were ultimately his?
Oh, absolutely. He was the one who was making that decision, and particularly because he was understandably frightened that they could end up in a nuclear war, and he was absolutely on the mark in that regard, as we know from subsequent openings of Soviet materials, documents that showed how close we came to a nuclear conflict. And he was deeply concerned about this, and there was pressure on him to bomb the missile sites in Cuba and then invade. And he resisted that and came to the judgment that he should try diplomacy first, which turned out to be what he called a quarantine. It was essentially a blockade, but that's an act of war, so he called it a quarantine instead. And that worked and forced Khrushchev to pull those missiles out of Cuba. And that deepened his confidence in the idea that he was his own best advisor, that, yes, he should hear them out, and he did. And he would listen to to all sides for as long as possible. But at the end of the day, he was the one, the responsible party. And he didn't want to go down in history as the man, the president, who fought a nuclear war. And as he said to this young mistress who he had in one night at the White House during the missile crisis, he said, "Mimi, I'd rather my kids be red than dead." Now, he never could have said that in public, but it was the measure of how deeply concerned he was not to get into a nuclear conflict.
You write in the book about how Kennedy described himself as always on the edge of irritability. The strains of the office certainly were upon him.
Without question. And also, remember, he had all sorts of health problems.
Right.
And in order to deal with the pressures and the tensions, he was on a variety of medications, including steroids to help him deal with his Addison's disease, because this was the principal medical difficulty that he had.
I think it's fascinating in the book, and you make this point, which is a point that I think we forget sometimes in looking at this 1,000 days, but the number of crises that he faced in that relatively short period of time is remarkable.
Yes, it was. It was a presidency that ran from one crisis to the next, first over Cuba and then over Berlin, and then crises in Mississippi and Alabama over civil rights, and crises over the disarray in Vietnam, and subsequent questions to the missile crisis as to what he should be doing about Cuba. And then, of course, coming up to his 1964 election, which drew him to go down to Texas in order to do some political fence mending in order to hopefully assure that he could keep Texas in his column in the 64 election.
Going back to 1962, you say that the president was very happy about his performance, certainly more so than he was at the end of the year before. There was a Gallup poll that said that 74% described Kennedy as the most admired man in the world. He was satisfied with his showing, and he liked that position.
Well, he did. He certainly did. He felt that he had learned certain things while he was president, not to trust certain advisors, particularly the military chiefs, who he became more and more skeptical of. And he felt that he was on track now to be a more successful president than he had been in the first year, when he felt he had stumbled so badly. And he was looking forward to running in 64, because he assumed his opponent was going to be Barry Goldwater. He hoped he would be. And as he joked with some of his aides, if Goldwater's our opponent, we're going to get to bed much earlier on election night than we did in 1960. So he was confident he'd win that re-election.
And really, starting out the year in 1963, the big question mark and the big issue, of course, was Vietnam.
Yes, without question, that became more and more of a great concern. We'll, of course, never know exactly what he would have done had he lived. But what is clear, I think, to me at least, from reading the documents and the exchanges he had with his advisors, he didn't want to escalate that war, in the sense that he didn't want to put massive numbers of ground troops in. George Ball, his Undersecretary of State, said to him, "Mr. President, you put 200,000-300,000 ground troops in Vietnam, in those jungles, you'll never hear from them again." And he said to Ball, "George, you're crazy as hell," meaning, I think, that he never was going to do that. What he would have done in Vietnam, we'll never know. He didn't know, but I don't think he ever would have put in 545,000 ground troops as Lyndon Johnson did.
You say in the introduction of the book, he was an imperfect man whose foibles made him receptive to some bad advice that triggered misjudgments. What do you think are the best examples of that type of behavior?
Well, I think the Bay of Pigs operation, where he so miscalculated what took such turned out to be such bad advice on how that operation could succeed, when in fact it was so much more of a problem. And he came to understand that the chiefs and the CIA thought if the operation faltered, which they thought it might well, Kennedy could never just let it go down the tube. He was going to send in American forces to assure that there was a victory. So he took that very much to heart. And so I think that was a big mistake. And also his caution in dealing with civil rights. He came to realize by 63 that, as he said, these Southerners keep saying they'll change, but they never will. And we have to act. We have to put that civil rights bill before Congress in order to right this historic wrong. And not just right a historic wrong, which was both a political and moral social issue in the United States, but it was also a foreign policy concern because the Soviets and Chinese were beating up on the United States as a racist society, and Kennedy felt it was jeopardizing our ability to influence and win the contest for hearts and minds in the developing world.
So as we commemorate the 50th anniversary of his assassination, it's interesting to note that here we are 50 years later, and we still have, our views are really still being formed. And in the epilogue, you play with this question as to what will the legacy be longer down the road. And I'm curious as to your thoughts on that, of how history will play out on this. And do you believe those numbers that we alluded to at the very beginning in the Gallup poll will change in people's thoughts about JFK?
I think it depends an awful lot on what happens, of course, in the future. If we get a president who inspires the country, see, what Kennedy gives people is the feeling that Johnson and Nixon and Ford and Carter and the two Bushes, that they just, people don't have a great regard for them, and they turn to Kennedy and to Reagan for kind of hope, inspiration. And if another president comes along who greatly inspires the country and creates a sense of a very upbeat sense creates a sense that there's a much more positive future because of what that president his or her performance, I think it will begin to eclipse Kennedy's hold on the country. But as long as the country stumbles and struggles and doesn't have a president that has the sort of regard for that it has for Kennedy, he's going to continue to command this kind of public loyalty.
What do you make of the attention around the anniversary? Obviously, yours is but just one book of many that are being written at this time. Many voices are speaking and talking about this man. And, of course, a lot is made about the assassination itself, and a lot is made about the president himself. And I'm curious just as to what you make of that conversation and what you think the American people should ultimately get out of this time and this experience of an anniversary of an even number.
Well, I think the attention to him and the preoccupation, so to speak, with Kennedy. You know, William McKinley was a popular president in 1901, elected to a second term. He was assassinated 50 years later. Hardly anybody remembered who he was. But Kennedy is filling a vacuum. He's filling a need in this country, the desire for a presidential hero, for someone they can look up to. He's frozen in our minds at the age of 46. Of course, the fact that he was so young and that it was an unfinished life, an unfinished presidency, as I've called it, gives him a kind of special hold on the country. But it's particularly the fact that they don't have other heroes. They don't have anyone else who they has the sort of aura and the halo around over him and kind of celebrity and appeal that Kennedy has. So until we get some other politician or president who can fill that bill, I think Kennedy and Reagan, too, are going to continue to be the most popular presidents in the public mind.
The name of the book is Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. The book is published by Harper. Robert Dalek, I thank you very much for spending time with us this morning. A great pleasure, as always, to speak with you.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Camelot's Court Inside the Kennedy White House. It is published by Harper. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.